Good morning on Friday, so I'm happy that there are still many people coming here to listen to the talk. And I probably will make the talk sort of slightly less precise than some of the previous ones in this workshop, and I hope you wouldn't mind. So my hope is that I would be able to convey the main idea without bothering with all these detailed definitions or assumptions. Of course, if you have any questions, you can still stop me and then ask me to clarify them. So I will start with some kind of motivating example. So, well, so what are the kind of questions we are interested in? So we will be, in some kind, we want to understand this kind of question. So suppose I have a group, gamma, inside a group, just for example, like SUPQ, the rational point of it, and this arithmetic subgroup. So when you define something like this, you might use some kind of Hermitian pairing with signature PQ over some imaginary quadratic field, for example. Then that would naturally give you some kind of integral structure. But being arithmetic means that it is sort of closely related to that sort of Z version of this group. And I would probably just, for technical simplicity, assume it is neat, although it's probably easy to get a case with all this assumption after you have the neat result for the neatness. And if you have something like this, you can consider finite dimensional representations of this thing. And those things will actually be similar to the representations of GLN, so you can, you know how to parameterize them. So I would start with something like this. So this is a finite dimensional representation of, if I call this G, of G with its highest weight. And I will probably just label the things like in decreasing, I mean using this decreasing sequence of integers. And then if you have something like this, you can now ask the following question. So for example, if you compute the cohomology, basically the group cohomology with coefficients here, and then you can ask what, how much we know about this thing. So I can put it as a fact. So this is zero for I smaller than the sort of the expected minimal dimension if this mu is regular. Regular just means basically all these numbers are different in this case. I realize that there are many different versions of regularity in this workshop, and this is certainly not the same one you have seen before, but this is the one you learn when you have finite dimensional representations. So the idea is that if you have this some kind of wild chamber parameterizing all the weights, being regular basically means that you are not on the wall, you are sufficiently different from something like this. That's a regular, you can say that it's away from wall in the vowel chamber. Okay, so if you have something like this, well, maybe I should say how people know this kind of thing. So I learned this fact from the work of Lee and Schmermer, I think it's 2004. And later I learned that it's also available in a work by Saper, 2005. And the proofs are all based on some kind of transcendental considerations. So the work of Lee and Schmermer uses this sort of isosine cohomology. So usually this kind of cohomology are defined using, you can use the symmetry spaces or the quotients to study them, and you can actually reduce that to some kind of, well, not reduce, but relate that to a question about automorphic forms and so on. So the isosine cohomology classes are defined by something based on isosine series. But the work of Saper is probably a slightly different one. It's probably a more geometric kind of concept. This method of L modules or something, when they use similar techniques to prove Zucker's conjecture. But these are all very transcendental arguments. And maybe I have to say that later today in my lecture, I'm not going to use anything about automorphic forms because basically we're studying the Torsion version of that and we don't have enough tools for them. So it will be slightly different. So if we have some result like this, the natural question is the following. Well, not everybody will ask these questions, but these were the questions we had when we have this kind of questions and results. So the first is do we have an algebraic proof The reason I ask this question is because these kind of cohomologies are certainly very closely related to the cohomology of Shimov varieties. So if you can formulate everything using varieties and vector bundles on it, then you can naturally ask whether you do need something transcendental to prove this kind of result. That's, well, maybe that's not a question you really have to ask, but I shouldn't ask this question myself. The second thing, which is probably more interesting or more related to the topic we have here, is that do we have an integral or torsion version of this result? So the reason I ask this thing is because if you think about the meaning of this Archimedean subgroup, it is sort of closely related to some kind of Z version, I mean the integral version of this group. So presumably you can actually ask the same question with this Q replaced by Z if you want. And if you ask that question, then you can consider some kind of invariant lattice inside this sort of complex orientation space. You can actually have a sort of integral lattice or something and then ask the action of gamma on that lattice. And then you can still ask this question. You can still compute the group cohomology with gamma here and then with the lattice there. Then you can ask whether we still have enough information about that thing. For example, whether we know that after localizing at T, this kind of result still holds. These are interesting questions by themselves. So let me at least write down the kind of things. So we want to ask the following. We want to ask if this, I guess, let me put it this way, although you might protest what this really means. If this thing is also zero for I smaller than D, this is the kind of question you can ask. Or in fact, you can put FP here if you like. And the idea is that if you know enough information about this torsion version, you actually also know information about the integral version. That's because you can always write down some kind of short exact sequence. So in fact, the FP version implies the ZP version because of the following. So you can always write down a short exact sequence. Wow. You can multiply by T. And then you can multiply again. This is the short exact sequence you can start with. And then after you have this, you can write down the corresponding long exact sequence. So you have something like this. Maybe I'll put it here. Well, I omitted the gamma, but you can put the gamma inside if you want. I think I actually want this best line above it. And then you can continue. So the idea is that if I know some kind of vanishing for the FP version below the middle degree and so on, then actually by just chasing with all these diagrams, I can get the vanishing for the ZP version as well. Even better, I also know the freeness. Also get freeness. By freeness, I mean the P-torsion freeness of this module. So by proving a vanishing result for the torsion version, we can actually also get not just the vanishing for the ZP version, we can also get the freeness result for this middle degree. And what is good about this is that if you go back to the original question, we can actually pose a question using like just Z. And now if you have such kind of result, you can at least say, well, for P greater than some particular kind of explicit bound, you cannot find anything sort of torsion in that, for those kind of P's. Then it's like saying that if you start with a Z here, you have precise condition on where and when you can find torsion or non-zero element in the cohomology. So this is why this is interesting to look at the torsion version of the statement. It looks like you have a question. Ah, so what do we do here? What are your favorite integers? R and S? I'm sure that they can maybe come back later. Yeah. So we can use different phones on this kind of thing. Yeah, so this P is not that P. well, they can be the same in some cases. The best thing is that now this is all recorded, so I cannot say too many stupid things. So, of course, if we have these questions, and if I'm giving a talk here, I'm supposed to have some answer for them. So the answer is yes, but with some conditions on P. And depending on your application, some people might find these conditions very restrictive, because somehow, I mean, I can imagine that in Toby's talk, you would find out that there are some applications which actually does not work if you just have such kind of weaker result. On the other hand, we actually can do this thing for everything that this first question can make sense for ourselves. So when we say algebraic proof, we use Schmalt varieties, and I think I only know about pair-type Schmalt varieties. So we can actually do this for basically all pair-type Schmalt varieties at once without any special treatment. So on the other hand, the result is sufficiently general, but maybe it is not as sharp as it should be in some special cases. Yeah. I'm going to explain in more detail what are true. Yes, for. You mean abstractly you get one. Yeah. So the question, in fact, we want a precise condition like this. So we will have a function, a condition like the following. Like you can have the kind of vanishing if P is greater than some constant depending only on mu, independent of level. So this is the important thing. Otherwise, you can say this is abstract nonsense. If I find a generating module, then for sufficient large T, of course, you don't see torsion. Yeah. We need it to be independent of level, and otherwise, this is an empty result. So now the question is, how can we possibly prove things like this? So I already sort of reduced the question to the case that you only need the FP version. But still, it is not clear how you should do it. So now this is the next thing I'm going to explain. So the idea to prove this for proving this kind of thing is that although I said that we probably don't really have techniques related to automorphic forms, but we will still try to write down some kind of algebraic version of automorphic forms sort of on the special fiber of the Schmalt varieties. And we will use those kind of automorphic or modular forms in the characteristic fiber to deduce results about these kind of things. So let me write down the strategy. So you use maybe I will just call them modular forms. Special fibers of Schmalt varieties and in fact I want to clarify that we're not doing all kinds of sort of complicated or difficult things here, so we are actually just using good reduction models of PO type Schmalt varieties here. So we are not doing something overly ambitious. So I have to warn you that when I say it is independent of level, I cannot really allow levels to be sort of intertwined with P. They should just stay away from each other. But the formula itself is not this thing looks like it is a complicated formula, like exponential function or something, but it's not. It's basically just some linear sum of the integers you see in the things here. So let me at least try to give you a slightly more precise thing we are going to show. So we will show the following. So we will compute the HI. Now I will really use the Schmalt variety, not just this gamma. So the idea is that when we compute the group homology with respect to gamma, you can use the attached symmetry space, this local symmetry space. And if you have a local symmetry space, they actually appear as kinetic components of Schmalt varieties. So in order to show that the cohomology is zero, you might as well show that the cohomology of something slightly bigger is also zero. So with this finite error of these kinetic components, I can actually turn the question into a question about cohomology of Schmalt varieties. So I will write down, I think there. Sorry? Yes. I mean, I don't think I can do anything without that assumption. Yeah. So I will start with some kind of Schmalt variety. What's our favorite letter for open compact so far? What's the most common one? Maybe it is K. Maybe I will regret about this later. And we also won't use K for some other groups, maybe. And now we use the complex Schimmel variety here. And now we consider some kind of... So this might be sort of a bit heavy in terms of notations. I would say that emphasize this is a Betti kind of local system. It's just local system with particular weight mu, and I will still have this. So instead of writing this SP bar quotation mark all the time, I just write a K. But this is the sort of sufficient large Wiener field you use in this case. I want to show that this is zero for I smaller than the dimension, which is now exactly the dimension of the Schimmel variety, the complex analytic dimension of the Schimmel variety. But we need to specify the conditions we have with a condition. So firstly, in the case of unitary groups, I can basically keep the same kind of assumptions of regularity. But in general, we also have other kinds of Schimmel varieties. And our method actually will force us to be slightly farther away from the walls in the case of type C or type D factors. So the condition is that, this is another thing I don't have a good name for, so something we call sufficient regular, but it's not that stringent. Sufficient regular means that if you pair this with a coroute from each of the simple factors, this is at least one if alpha comes from a type A vector and is 2 if it comes from the type C vectors or type D, type C or type D vectors. So this is the condition we need on mu. And we also will have a constant C mu. Maybe if I have time, I will spell this out later when we know the method, but otherwise now it is just a complicated formula which doesn't have much meaning. And we need the P to be greater than the C mu. By the way, we can always choose the C mu to be greater than all these kind of ramifications or other things, so of course I can assume that P is larger than, for example, all the prime factors of discriminant I need in the definition data of the Schimmel variety. I can also make sure that this weight mu is going to be sort of small compared with this P in the sense that I can make sense of this module without ambiguity. So in the theory involving torsion, in fact, the choice of this lattice or this module is actually not unique in general. So for very large mu, you need to say what it means by this. But on the other hand, when P is large compared with this weight, there's no ambiguity. There's after isomorphism of your canonical choice. So in fact, even to make sense of this statement, we need this P to be greater than some bound defined by this mu. Of course, that bound is not ridiculous. It's just, again, you just write down all the integers you involve in here and check some linear formula and just make sure P is greater than that. Is there some question? You mean just for the lattice, you have a different...
Yeah,
but our method actually doesn't allow us to treat these large weights anyway, so... Yeah, so that's a question we are not even be able to arrive at. So for now, our other parts of the method actually force us to be staying at the bottom part of the alcove. But that would certainly be a sensible question after you can deal with all the other geometric difficulties and work with larger weights. Oh, by the way, I have not really said anything about the so-called compact support cohomology, but now that you formulate things using geometry, you might as well ask what happens with the compact support cohomology. Then the statement will be that the compact support cohomology vanishes when I is greater than the middle dimension D. So you have a sort of dual statement for the compact support cohomology. And once you have the statement for the compact support cohomology, you can also talk about this interior cohomology, namely the image of the compact support in the usual cohomology. Then we have this sort of nice result in some sense that for the middle dimension, I mean for the interior cohomology, everything is concentrated in the middle dimension. You don't see them elsewhere. But then we start to see pathologies explaining some kind of failure exactness in this three-term. For the interior cohomology, you will have a three-term for degree D, but that is actually not exact here in general. So I think there are still a lot of unanswered questions, even if we have that kind of concentration in middle degree. I probably will not have time to say too much about them, so I'll skip them for now. So how do we prove something like that? So how to prove this? So to reduce this question to something we can really do anything about, well, I mean, I or a collaborator together can do anything about, we have to relate this thing to something else. And as I said, I want to relate them to modular forms on special fibers. And I have to admit that for this reduction step, I have to use a lot of black boxes I don't really know how to prove. So, for example, I have to use some kind of comparison theorems between Etal and Crisson cohomology, which I just have to trust the expert's opinion. So, provided that we have that, I'm going to tell you how to reduce this question to the question we want to study. So, let me start with that thing. So, this HI, this SH, the specy version, this K here. And then the first thing you can do is you can turn this into a Etal cohomology over C. I don't think people really say this in this workshop, but it actually makes sense. So by Etal cohomology over C, of course, I think this is Michael Arkin's comparison between the complex analytic and the Etal cohomology. And then you can study, once you have Etal cohomology, Etal cohomology is unchanged if you pass between sort of separable, extensions between separately closed fields. So I can actually go down to Q bar and then move to QP bar if you want. So you can actually relate this to this time I change this to QP bar. And then still the Etal version of the sheaves. But once you have Etal cohomology, as I mentioned, you can now start to compare this with something else. And now I use the fact that we actually have, so in case as this Schumann variation is not compact, we have nice compactifications over this integer. I mean, like if you have P, you have ZP or like WFP bar. You have good integral models over there where you don't just have good integral model in the interior. You also have good compactifications in the sense that the divisor you put at the infinity are having sort of smooth irreducible components. So you don't really have any accident in this kind of picture. So if you have that kind of perfect setup, you can actually compare this thing. Well, in fact, I'm slightly cheating because you actually also need to use these Kugels varieties. So good compactification of them as well. If you use all of these, which is not so trivial, but still reasonably trivial for this, compared with this comparison, you can actually compare this to, so I would be careful. So far we want this to be zero. The question is whether this is zero. Now the next thing we want to ask is whether something else is zero. So we just need some kind of comparison which allows us to link the vanishing of this with the vanishing of something else. I'm not sure if this simplifies the matter at all, but we can ask a similar question for the crystalline version of things. But now I'm going to turn things into this, I don't have a good way to say it. So there's something I will call the log crystalline cohomology. And this time I'm going to formally say what I'm going to use. So, I mean, with this log structure, I have to use the so-called toroidal compactification. But fortunately, this has already appeared several times in this workshop, so I don't have to say too much about them. And then you use the special fiber of the toroidal compactification, and you will consider the crystalline version of this, but I would just put crystalline version of this. But this time, because this is a compactification, we have to suitably extend the things to the boundary. So we actually need some kind of canonical extension of this thing. I'm going to say a little bit about them. The idea is like, if you have the sheaf of differentials, now you need something like differentials with log poles towards infinity. So this is the kind of things you expect when you write down the connections or crystals or something. And then you compare with this. But to be honest, I still don't want to work with the crystalline cohomology. So I will translate that to the round cohomology, which is the only thing I really know. So I will translate it to the round cohomology. this is probably the log around cohomology. And I think by this line, I have a better idea what I'm talking about. So this is the Durand version of everything. And how exactly do people compute the Durand cohomology? They write down the Durand complex and then calculate hypercohomology. So this is by definition the same as the hypercohomology here of this toroidal thing. And then I write down the Durand complex for this thing. So oh, by the way, I haven't told you why I put a dual somewhere, right? Now you'll be clear in the next step. I actually added a dual everywhere so far. So I will consider the complex with log poles along infinity. Once I have this kind of hypercohomology, I can actually write down a special sequence just by abstract nonsense. So I can actually have a special sequence. So I have the graded teeth, the Hodge graded teeth of the same thing here. This page is not big enough. Now I just switch to the other side. So a priori studying the hypercohomology of a complex is still too difficult. I mean, usually we have no idea what is going on if you have too many terms in a complex. So the next thing to do is to replace this Hodge version of the Durand complex with something even easier. So I think this is known since Fulkins I don't know how long ago, I don't remember the precise date, but so the idea is to replace this with something we call the dual BGG complex, but this is the easier version of dual BGG in the sense that I'm only talking about the Hodge version of this, which means that this is a complex of all modules. It doesn't really involve differential operators. So in this case, it's actually easier to verify and justify this thing. So then we will have something I will call the BGG version of this thing. Well, the notation is going to be very ugly, but let me write it anyway. The Hodge version of the BGG complex. So what is this thing? So let me now spell out this thing for you. So this thing is actually up to some kind of shift. So I started with this thing here. And now I can probably explain why I need a dual here. So the dual is only because I'm more used to write this formula, and I think this is a simpler way to write the formula. So you can basically take this sort of dot action. You can have this so-called vial element. You can take some kind of representatives. So I'm going to tell you what these sheaves are later. This is sort of non-compact representatives of the vial element. And if you do this kind of dot action, you will get a lot of other ways. And you sum this up, and then you subtract your shift actually by the length of the vial element. So I probably have to use a special phone, right? What is your favorite phone for via element? I don't know. Old Faith? Okay, something different. The via element. And I have to explain what this W is. So maybe it's easier to explain what they are using a special case. So what is the special case I have in mind? So the special case is the following. Let me write on another board and come back. The end result doesn't depend on the choices, but maybe it's easier for me to first tell you what these are in the special case, otherwise. I haven't even explained what this sheaves are, right? Before I explain what these are, maybe I cannot really say how I choose this thing, okay? Yeah, I just hope to make sure that other people in the audience know what we are talking about. How do we think about these W's and so on? So let me first begin with a special case of how people think about these kind of things. So an important special case is the following. And in fact, we all have seen this. Well, I mean, most of you have seen this. So when you study modular forms, there's this sort of Eicher-Shimura isomorphism. So the important special case is that so what does this say in the case of modular curves or modular forms? Basically, you will try to study the cohomology H1 of, for example, you can say the gamma, and then you have the sim k, maybe sim k minus 2 or sim k, just put sim k here of the standard orientation of GO2. So this is the, so of course you can have GO2 acting on this. And then you can actually write this as a sum of modular forms of weight k plus 2 and level gamma with a complex conjugate of the cusp forms. And how do we relate these two to something we know over there? So that then this is actually the H0 over the modular curve of this familiar omega to k plus 2 plus, if you use Sayre duality, you can translate this thing to H1 of something of negative weight. So how do I interpret this as a special case of that? So now I can probably start to explain what these sort of W kind of sheaves are. So when you define your Shimura varieties, you have this H, this defining the Hall structure on the data. This H itself will give you some kind of Hall decomposition and so on. So that Hall decomposition actually allows you to define a parabolic subgroup of the complex group of the thing. So when you talk about non-compact roots or something, basically you use that H to give you a choice of a parabolic and also how to split the levy, and then you get a choice. Yeah. But I'm afraid that I have to explain to other people in the audience too. So, okay. All right. So in this very special case, how do you think about this? This is something I would put maybe like WVK dual. So you can think of this mu as just being a single number up to some twist in the this weight or something. It's a single number k. So you can imagine now you have this. So for GL2, or maybe SL2 essentially, you have this chamber being all the positive integers on one side. And what do you do when you do this dot action? When you do this dot action, actually you have only two possible viable elements, this trivial element and this non-trivial element. This non-trivial element will move everything to the other side. So if you have k here, it goes to negative k minus 2. And if you take negative k minus 2 and take the dual, you get this wk plus 2 here. This is what you get here. And this 0 is dropped down from 1 by this number 1, which is the length of this viable element. And here, this 1 is the same as this 1, which is the case when the length of the w is 0. And you just stay the same weight. Basically, this is negative k in this case. I guess this is not sufficient as an explanation, so we can give you. I can give you another special case. Okay. Another special case is probably this case of Zygo threefold or something. Up to the center is this. This is how I probably would draw a diagram. Well, the degree is wrong, but and this is 0, 0. This is -3, -3. 0, -2. Something like this. And you start with the element here, k1 and k2. I'm not sure if we are conscious enough to pin down all the precise number, but I can at least draw a picture. So you reflect this side, and this side. And you basically have four possible viable elements, and each of them actually have length. So if you stay here, this is length equals 0. this is when length equal to 1, this is when length equal to 2, and this is length equal to 3. If you now look at that formula, now it says that you have something from H0 contributing to H3 of the group cohomology. So when you want to contribute the middle dimension, you can have this kind of so-called holomorphic modular forms here. But then you also have non-holomorphic things. So you also have things in H1 contributing to H3. So H1 of some kind of vector bundle will contribute to H3 of the group cohomology we actually care about. And then you also have H2 and H3. And in fact, this H0 and H3, along this direction, they're related by serial duality. So in fact, they're complex conjugates of each other. But when you do serial duality, you have this sort of, along the boundary, you actually introduce some kind of boundary divisor there when you actually have to do the serial duality because of this Kodaira-Spencer isomorphism. So when you do the complex conjugation between these two chambers, you sort of turn Cox forms into non-Cox forms, turn forms with Coxeter condition into forms without Coxeter condition. And this is the same thing you see here. You have this usual, all modular forms here, and the Cox forms there. So all these kind of phenomena are the same in general. So although there's a formula there, I just want to convince that they boils down to something quite concrete and explicit in special cases. If I have that, then I can rewrite this. If you don't mind, I'll just write this non-compact. And we sort of turn the question about the rank homology into questions about cohomology of vector bundles. Now I have to draw the degree. So it's I minus the length of the Y element. Sometimes people will say this is the shortest representative or something. I mean, there is something you can say to pin down exactly how to choose this representative. But another way to understand this representative is easier. So another way to understand this representative is that starting with the mu you have, these are the only representatives so that this is another dominant way for this smaller group. That's the equivalent way to pin down exactly what you need. So I just have just hidden this here. If I want to show this as zero or not, I mean, determine whether it's zero or not, it's not easy when I want to show this as non-zero, but if I just want to show it as zero, if I just want to show this as zero, it's enough to go back to this step where you have a special sequence and show that everything on this side is zero. And then it's enough to show that everything like this is zero. So in fact, if I can show that all these vector bundles have zero cohomology, I can actually finish here. Oh, by the way, I forgot to put, so these are actually canonical extensions, but I guess it's too much of a digression to explain what these things are. So if I can show all these vector bundles have zero cohomology, I can conclude that there I have zero cohomology. And I forgot to mention this this big black box, which I cannot, this is the crystalline comparison. This is a big black box I don't want to say too much about. My feeling is that the technology is being pushed forward every day, and someday people will have a much better proof for this step. For now, I would just acknowledge that this is done by somebody else. Sorry? In fact, we need assumptions a prime to be almost everywhere. The first thing I have to make sense of this thing that already requires this way to be smaller compared to a prime. Of course, the comparison also have given me a size. Without assuming that P is sufficiently large, I cannot do the comparison well with these torsion coefficients. Some people in the audience actually can tell me maybe even better things. At this step, basically everything is formal, but to show this is zero, I would need another important input. There, I will again need prime to be big to be able to do that. So I will actually have basically three major sources of concern in some sense, and I'm just explaining the basic reduction steps, but then this thing is still the important thing because so far I have never used the assumption that mu is sufficiently regular. So there's no way we can prove something like that without using the most important assumption. By the way, I should mention that the result is not right if mu is not sufficiently regular. So for example, if you take mu to be a trivial weight, it's just easily seen to be false. And in fact, it seems to be possible to create counterexamples with as much failure as possible you want, already in the trivial weight case. So for example, you can find something such that H0 of the trivial weight or something sort of has this dimension on each fiber can jump up by any number you like. So already for U21 Schirmer variety, you can find as much failure as possible just in H0 of the trivial weight. So I think without using the assumption that this is sufficiently regular, we are not really doing anything yet. So now I have to explain how to use this assumption of sufficiently regular weight. Let me erase this. So far, I haven't said what I is, right? So
eventually
I will be below the middle. And eventually you will see why we need I to be below the middle. Yes. Yeah, I will tell you why we need I to be below the middle. Well, I hope I can manage to tell you that in 20 minutes. So how do we study that at all? I mean, how do we show that something like that is zero? And in fact, the truth is that we actually started thinking about this first before we actually think about this problem. So the truth is that at some point, so I was just chatting with my collaborator, Jinkyu, about this kind of problem. So he was just asking me what kind, I mean, he's thinking about vanishing of some kind of other kind of thing. So in variational geometry, there are all these kind of questions about this plurality genera. Just take the canonical bundle and then take the high powers and see if they have like vanishing or something, or like freeness or sort of kind of nice properties. And then at some point we were discussing whether these kind of things also make sense for modular forms. Because modular forms, I mean, these canonical line bundles define things which are sort of special cases of modular forms. So it's sometimes sensible to ask about the same question for modular forms. And then we started to search literature and find out what people actually know about vanishing of anything like that. And the first thing we actually found was this Illouz's vanishing theorem. The reason we care about Illouz's vanishing theorem is the following. So he has a vanishing theorem explaining the following setup. So if you have a family of varieties, namely you have morphism from one variety to another, which is reasonably nice, namely say it is smooth or semi-stable, then you can compute the relative cohomology, namely the push-pull of the thing on the constant on the top to the things on the bottom. And then you get some kind of vector bundles on the bottom. Well, not necessarily vector bundles, but they can be coherent sheaves and so on. In general, they can be just coherent sheaves which are not locally free. I would call these kind of things sort of things of geometric origin, namely they are not just arbitrary vector bundles. They come from vector bundles that is related to the family of varieties. And for these kind of things coming from a family of varieties, we actually have better control on when the cohomology vanishes or not. So the theorem you can have is the following. So you can write down this kind of thing. So instead of just having that thing, usually for this kind of vector bundles of geometric origin, you have to twist them by some kind of ample or anti-ample line bundle. So the statement you can have, so this uses this theorem. In the now I have to say something. Let me assume this is compact, so I can at least say, assuming assuming this is compact. I'm going to come back to the non-compact case later with a stronger input. So what can we say when this is compact? So when the complex fiber of the Schirmer variety is compact, this actually implies with some effort, well, I think the only proof I know uses theory of degeneration of other varieties. There are probably two proofs of this, but they are essentially all based on the same kind of thing. This has a proper integral model. So there's no need to consider all these sort of possibility that it is not really proper in a special fiber. It's proper. And in fact, I haven't said anything about what U is. So suppose, and assuming U is neat, then this is proper smooth, representable by something proper smooth. And we can actually, and liftable to something, a proper smooth scheme over W2. So the illusion theory requires some divisibility to the second wave vector of this finite field. Then you can have the following. I'm translating what we really have in Lewis's paper into what we have here. So in our context, now I can just write this remember without the toroidal quantification. I have this vector bundles of a geometric origin. Well, if you have not heard of this, basically, whenever you have this kind of bundles, we can probably call automorphic. They're actually sort of summons of something of geometric origin. So the standard trick is to take these sorts of called Kugel-Sato varieties or Kugel varieties. So you can take the sort of the universal abelian scheme. The cohomology of the universal abelian scheme looks like the standard orientation. And if you take a fiber product of that over the Schumann variety, you start to copy the same thing several times. And then if you consider the cohomology of that several copies of the same thing, you actually get the tensor algebra of all the things you have. Anything is a standard fact in just finite dimensional representations, finite dimensional representations of these kind of groups that if you have any kind of finite dimensional representation, you can realize it as a summon, at least for small ways, as a summon of this tensor algebra kind of thing. So we are going to do that. And what happens is that if you tensor with some, the dual of some ample line bundle, so this L is zero for I smaller than D, and this L is ample. So if you have something ample, then below the linear dimension, things vanish. Okay. Let me skip the proof or the idea of proof for now, and let me see how to use this. So how do we actually use this? So the question is how to choose this L. And in general, we don't really have a good supply of ample line bundles on Schumann varieties. I think in essence, we only know one possible clear choice of this L. So this L is the same L you have seen in the model curve case. So you take this universal family of Abelian schemes, take the determinant of its relative algebra, and then you get some line bundle. And I think that is the only line bundle we know for sure is ample when it is already a proper variety. In fact, if you know any other way to create ample line bundles, I would be very happy to know because that creates a different source of quasi projectivity for our Schumann varieties. I don't think we have them. So we will take, we want L to be ample automorphic, and that means we want L to be of the form like this W. Defining a one-dimensional representation and such that which is also ample. And it's not, as I said, there's essentially one choice up to some kind of scaling or something. So in fact, you can basically write down a weight. So I mentioned this determinant of the standard orientation. So that's the way when you have one all the way in any reasonable way you describe your limitations, something like that. So if you put this back in the picture, how do we use this? So now we have this result for I smaller than D, and if you twist by the weight, you have vanishing. So the idea is that if you don't twist the weight, you don't have vanishing. On the other hand, this result is actually all sensible if you put the dual statement here. So let me also write down another dual statement there. Another statement is also useful is the following. If I tensor the ample thing without taking the dual, if L is ample, so it's basically saying that above the middle degree, things vanish if you tensor with the ample thing. Below the middle degree, things vanish by tensing something anti-ample. So basically, this is the anti-ample case and it's the ample case. And to really use this result, we now think of the following statement. So Lewis's theorem implies that after shifting by some kind of small vector, we have vanishing. So if you start with any weight and shift it a little bit, you get vanishing. But you don't get vanishing if you stay there. So although SP4 is not giving you a complex Schumann variety, but let me use that picture to help us understand this idea. So what are these small waves? So for example, in this picture, you are just going to shift, for example, along these two directions. So you are allowed to shift in those two directions in each of the chambers. And of course, these directions do not stay the same after you do the violet reflections. So what is in this direction? Well, luckily they are in the same direction, but they are in opposite way. How about these two? These two will be shifted into something like that. So you have to shift in sort of all possible directions if you reflect back to the original chamber. On the other hand, instead of thinking about shifting from the given way then to go to somewhere else, you can just think the other way around. You can start from somewhere else and come back. So you can start with a nearby thing and then try to shift back. So Illusion's theorem now implies that if there's anybody near you so that you can come back from there, then you also have vanishing. If you think this way, the problem becomes much easier because instead of sorting out all the complicated combinatorics or so, well, basically, I'm not even sure what you should sort out there, but now you can just come back from all nearby ways and then try to get the vanishing there. So the idea is that each of the violet elements will give you some kind of vanishing for part of the cohomology. And if you have a sum like this, in order to get the vanishing for all possible W, you just need to allow room in your violet chamber to shift from all nearby places and come back. And this is actually why we need a sufficient regularity condition. So sufficient regularity ensures that there's enough room to shift from nearby ways. And if you have this enough room to shift from nearby ways, you can have the vanishing once you have some kind of elusive type of vanishing result. And also, I want to also explain a little bit why we have this distinction between size being 1 or 2 when we have these different types of the grooves. So, if you think about the type C situation, then the weight 1111 that's written down here, this is necessary. We don't really have other choice. And what happens if you add something like 1111 and then do the reflection? So what happens when you do the violet reflection of this 1111? Basically, you have some permutation and change the sign of some of them. So by applying the violet element to this new, you get something like 1111 and jump to -1, -1, -1, and so on. So there's a jump of size 2 in the type C case. So let me write this down. So in the type C or type D case, you have this small weight, small vector, you try to shift things around, and when you apply the violet reflection, you will get something like this. There's a jump by size 2. This means that if you have a sequence of integers in the beginning, you have to allow room for them to jump by, to shrink by this size 2 and then still stay a dominant weight. That means that you actually have to allow yourself to be away from the wall by distance square root of 2 or something. So this is basically why you need 2 here. And why are things different from the type A case? Firstly, you don't have to change the sign in the type A case. Basically, it stays either 1 or 0. And in fact, you can even choose something better. You can do this. So to be more precise, you have UPQ. On part of it, you have a slightly different sign convention. But if you just make a clever choice so that it's 1111 and then 0, 0, 0 on the second part. So it's more like if you have UPQ, you have like P and Q here. Oh, I said I shouldn't use P and Q. So this was R and S. So if you have the URS there, you have something like that. And what happens after you do the violet element here? You might shuffle them around and make it something like 111 and 0, 0, 0. And then come back to 111 again, and then 0, 0, 0 again. So the biggest gap you can find in this sequence of elements is always just like 1. You never have to stay farther away from the wall. And this is the main reason you can actually do a better result in the type A case. So in the type A case, you sort of have two kinds of choices of this small ample weight. So this ample weight can be basically something like this. Or in fact, you can also choose something like 0, 0, 0, and -1, -1 there. And in both of the cases, depending on the sign convention, you can also have this. And then again, after the shift around, you also have the jump at most just 1. Of course, if you use something like 1, 1, 1, 1, and then -1, -1, you will have the jump to be 2, but that's something you don't need to do when you just need this argument. So in practice, once you have the correct input of this vanishing theorem, this abstract kind of vanishing theorem from UDC or somewhere else, you can actually use them and play this game and then just shift the weights around and get the vanishing you want when you are sufficiently far away from the walls. So this seems to be a purely geometric fact that doesn't really use anything very deep about automotive forms or Galois limitations. So I want to emphasize that there has been some older results which talks about vanishing, which doesn't require this this sufficient regular condition. On the other hand, they have this kind of condition, like if you have an attached Galois limitation, if you localize a non-isotherm prime and so on, you can get some kind of vanishing. So this is a different kind of approach, namely we put a stronger condition on the weight, but at the same time we don't need any condition on the Galois limitations. So it depends on what you want to do. Maybe this can provide some different perspective. And maybe I can have 5 minutes to say what to do with this degree. Okay, so let me first quickly mention why we need this D here. So when we prove this kind of illusory kind of result, in the end we have the Hodge complex, which has size. Basically it will have degree from 0 to D. So you will have a complex involving degrees, sort of a width of D or something. And then in the end, the idea is to use the so-called Frobenius element to help us. So the idea is that if you have something ample, and you usually prove something called the decomposition theorem, which allows you to sort of, after push forward by relative Frobenius, to sort of detach the whole complex into just a simpler one, like essentially the graded piece of it. And if you have that, then if you tensor this L, another magical thing that Frobenius can do is basically to turn any L into its fifth power. So if you can keep playing this trick and then raise the power of L into something higher and higher, you can have some kind of basically Serre vanishing result. So Serre has this following result saying that if you have a coherent sheaf, if you tensor a sufficient high power of the ample line bundle, then you have the vanishing above some degree. Or if you tensor something anti-ample, you get the opposite kind. You have a vanishing below degree zero. But we don't want to talk about below degree zero in this case. So why do we have degree D? That's because our complex has D, have things up to degree D. So if your complex has things up to degree D, you can write down some naive special sequence for the complex. Then you have to allow your room to go up to D to have vanishing or something. So this D comes from the fact that when you actually compute things, you actually have complexes of length, I mean from degree 0 to degree D. So the naive set of vanishing would work if you allow degree go up to D. Then the question is, what can we do in the non-compact case? And in the non-compact case, a lot of things break down. The first thing that breaks down is that when I talk about this kind of vanishing theorems given by UDC, which uses this families of geometric origin or something, I mean, vector bundles of geometric origin coming from families, UDC wanted this family to be semi-stable and liftable to W2K. Unfortunately, in the realm of Chernoff varieties, when we try to complexify these Kugel-Zoller varieties and so on, these Kugel varieties, I mean, self-fiber products of Abelian schemes, these kind of fiber products do not really have complexifications which are semi-stable over the complexification of the Chernoff varieties. So let me list all these pathologies. Not easy. So if it's not compact, then we will have, so firstly, we can complexify, well, essentially compare everything, but complexify this morphism from the Kugel-Zoller varieties to the Chernoff varieties into something we call the toroidal setup. I don't want to invent new notation, I just write the English words what they are. And while this is smooth, this is usually not too good. So this is not, for example, not semi-stable. I think in some cases it's provably not semi-stable. So what can you do then? You still have something which is something we call log smooth with some reasonable condition, but they all actually fail most of the conditions people want. For example, when people study this kind of log geometry, they sometimes have these conditions like Cartier type or something. None of them works. So basically nothing works. So what can you do? So we basically have to fight into the details of the condition. So firstly, we still want this push forward to be locally free. So we actually have to do some local cognition to prove that. And in fact, that is not something too surprising because in Faustian Chai, they already did the same kind of argument. after that, you still have to show a lot of other conditions, and you just have to check all of them. And then, I'm not sure whether it's lucky or not, we still have some reference that provides the thing we want. So we have, so we can still have useful facts like, well, techniques or facts of the following kind. So firstly, we still have some kind of decomposition theorem. I haven't really said what they are, but there's something called decomposition theorem, which allows you to decompose your Dirac complex after push forward by the relative forbidness. So this is decompose Dirac complex after push forward by relative forbidness. But this is not enough, because in the original argument, we still need to choose the ample line bundle. Unfortunately, the naive choice, this L or whatever we had in the compact case, doesn't extend that well into the non-compact case. The idea is that the naive choice of this determinant line bundle or something is ample on the so-called minimal compactification. If they are ample on the minimal compactification, they have no hope to be ample on the toroidal one, unless the toroidal is the same as the minimal. So usually there is a map from the toroidal to the minimal, which is not even finite. So if you have something ample on the bottom, it's not going to be ample on the top. So the second thing is that although we don't have the ampleness, so without an ample L, we still get something reasonable. Have something reasonable. I don't know whether it's sensible to write all this down. For something, there is a technique by Enoi Vivek. But to apply Enoi Vivek's technique, we need yet another input. So their argument is the following. Their argument is that instead of just replacing ample device power, like in the compact case, now we have something which is not ample, but it is actually close to being ample after you add some kind of vanishing along the boundary divisor. The problem is that when you pull back, the divisor has to change, right? If you pull back, then you have to sort of multiply the divisor by P, and you don't want to do that. Or in other words, you cannot divide by P, because very soon you're going to get fractional numbers. So what happens when you try to divide by P and then get something which is not an integer? Then you have to use the technical sort of residue. You have to study residue along the boundary, in the sense that usually you can have two complexes which differ by some kind of pose along the boundary. And if they differ by a pose along the boundary, and also if the residue along the boundary component where you have that pose is actually something we call nilpotent, if you have this kind of nilpotent residue condition, you can actually still have quasi-isomorphism between the two complexes. So this kind of magical quasi-isomorphism actually allows us to sort of divide by P and ignore the remainder. So if you can keep dividing by P and ignore the remainder, you can actually bridge together something non-ample with something actually turns out to be ample. Well, I'm being very brief in these statements, but let me write down the third input. So the third input is nilpotence of residue of this automorphic kind of sheet. And let me just hint a little bit why we get this kind of nilpotent residues. So if you imagine how you construct this vector bundle and so on over the compact numbers, you have a symmetric space in the form of the quotient. And in Monfort's construction of the toroidal compactifications, the things he actually do the quotient near the boundary are things which are actually part of this unipotent radical of this parabolic. So if you define your bundle by taking a quotient by something nilpotent, then the monodromy are all unipotent. And then Katz also said that if you have something unipotent, if you have a family, then that implies that you have something unipotent. Sorry, nilpotent as a residue. Yeah, so we are lucky enough to have all these inputs, and you just have to sit down and do an exercise. And in the end, we provide something similar to that in the case of non-compact Schumann varieties. So in a non-compact Schumann variety case, you have something similar, which is that you still have tensor L. So this L is now going to be a particular kind of for I, for D. But I have to say that the opposite statement would be the complex support version. And what is the complex support version? You have to cancel with the ideal of the curves. Well, let me just write negative infinity for I above the middle degree. And then now if you have this input, you can still finish the program as we have outlined in the beginning. So maybe, I don't know how important this remark is. So we have assumed a lot of things, right? So what psi are involved? But I said that there's a third source of input we need to worry about the psi. So when you do all these kind of decomposition theorem or vanishing theorem and so on, you need the prime to be sufficiently big so that all the sizes or degrees involved are smaller than p. That's the third place we need to worry about the psi. Now in the end, if you want to state the theorem, you take the maximum of all these sizes involved, then you get this c mu, this constant function we have, which is independent of the level, because so far we only care about the sizes. And all these relative dimensions do not change if you raise the level. So all these constants are independent of the level. But they do depend on other linear algebraic inputs. And that's where we get them. Maybe I should stop here. Thank you. Yes. No. Well, in some sense, yes, because in the end, you boil down the local calculations near the boundary, but I'm saying that it's not really used in any of these. I don't think you need to know that. In fact, in the proof, we hardly even need to know this kind of thing with the sheaf along this. Because you can get this from that by some kind of serial duality statement. If you have reasonable duality statement, you just need to prove one of them. And if you just need to prove one of them, you don't need to worry about this boundary divisor at all. Although I have to hint that when you compute the relative cohomology from the toroidal convection of the Kugel variety to the toroidal convection of the Schumann variety, you do have to write down some local charge and compute. And that kind of argument is indeed involved in all kinds of similar computations. So that is actually similar. Yes. Oh yeah. Yes. Where should I erase this? So you have white x, and then you have f, and you can consider the log relative differentials. So this. Let me do the smooth case. I mean, maybe it's easier. Smooth. And then you can consider the relative differentials. And then you consider the something like that. So you can compute the relative differentials. And for example, I can focus on one particular degree. There's nothing wrong with that. And then when I say it is of geometric origin, I'm saying that my vector bundles can actually be cut off from this thing by some kind of sort of idempotence acting on everything. So it's a summand of this kind of thing. And how do I state the vanishing or something kind of thing we have? The question is, I don't want this I, some A. Anyway, it's not very different. So now on X, I will look at the so-called the Durand complex of this H. So the idea is that if I start with the relative differential, there's a way to write down the so-called Gauss-Mannin connection and then create a complex out of that. So that complex itself will allow you to compute the Durand cohomology of this thing. But Elissier's theorem is not about the Durand cohomology, but rather about the Hodge cohomology. So you will actually take the Hodge graded piece of this thing. If you take the Hodge graded piece of this thing and then tensor with an ample thing, then this is zero for I smaller than D. And of course, you need the p to be greater than the total dimension or something involved. You can make it sharper, but I think it's irrelevant. Yes. Yeah, the easiest assumption is to make sure the total dimension of everything is smaller than p. But that's not sharp enough. So in fact, we actually did some exercise to to say something not already said in Lewis's paper, but without any work, it's just sort of thanking God what he actually said. So I think in his theorem, he actually says some bound, which is not as sharp as what he actually proved. So we did extract some sharper bound in his theorem. Oh, I forgot to say, liftable to W to K. Proper smooth, and with if you have ample amount of this, is actually projected smooth. Yeah. Let me say, proper smooth, projected smooth. I might have forgotten something, but I think all the important things are there. And if we want to improve this thing, the things we improve is, this thing is not supposed to be even semi-stable, but with some stronger condition on the radical homology, this thing does not have to be ample. We specify some kind of weaker version of ampleness, specified by NOV vec. And we have to assume that H has nilpotent residue along the boundary devices. Yeah, sorry. Okay.